Oceana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, three is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, three for the win, it's good! Villanova wins it!
He dives, it is a touchdown! New England wins!
Adios! Cubs win their ninth in a row!
Miles Boykin is in the end zone! The Irish have come back!
Your hosts are Eric Hansen and Darren Pritchett.
Good afternoon, everyone. SportsBeat on the air, 6 minutes after the top of the hour. Our program is brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some buds. Thanks for joining us on 96.1 FM WSBT, the live stream at WSBTradio.com. Maybe you're using the TuneIn Radio app to listen to our program. Podcast also available. We thank you for joining us on this Wednesday evening. I'm Darren Pritchett, WSBT Radio Sports Director. He is Eric Hansen, the Fighting Irish Football Insider for the South Bend Tribune. On the program this evening, next hour, we have a couple of guests. Alan Karpik, president and publisher of Golden Black Illustrated, joins us to talk about the third-ranked Purdue Boilermakers, who have won 17 consecutive games atop the Big Ten standings at 10-0. They're Bo Derek right now. They're rolling right along. So we'll talk to Alan coming up in just a few moments. Also at 6:30, we begin a series of Wednesday interviews with Tom Uziak, minor league correspondent for the Cubs Den. He's joined us the last couple of years to break down the best prospects in the Chicago Cubs system. And today we start the 2018 series by taking a look at the Chicago Cubs outfielders. A year ago at this time, we were talking about Eloy Jimenez, no longer, now a member of the Chicago White Sox organization. So Tom will join us in about an hour and a half to talk about the Cubs prospects in the outfield. This hour, in about 20 minutes, we'll talk about the NFL quarterback carousel that got underway yesterday with Alex Smith being traded from Kansas City to Washington. This eventually could affect Deshaun Kizer, the former Irish quarterback with the Cleveland Browns. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But in our opening segment, we want to talk a little bit about Durham Smythe, who had a nice Senior Bowl. But we start things off with a story that kind of caught me off guard. Didn't think we'd be going down this road, but at least one individual is taking us down this road. ESPN's First Take show with Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman. They argue over many sports topics. And with the recent decision by the Cleveland Indians to no longer use the Chief Wahoo logo on the Cleveland Indian uniforms, I understand that apparently the logo will be available for fans to buy on merchandise still, but it will not be on the Indians uniform. For example, it's been on their hat for a long time and on their jersey sleeve as well. So Chief Wahoo is going away from the Indians uniform. So this whole conversation on this show on ESPN led to, is Notre Dame's Fighting Irish and Leprechaun mascot, is that something that is detrimental to people of Irish descent? So I'm going to play the soundbite, and we'll have a discussion on this. This is also our SportsBeat Twitter question of the day on my Twitter account at 961SportsBeat. The Fighting Irish name or their mascot in some people's eyes are considered to be offensive to Irish people. Your reaction is, your two choices, worth considering or ridiculous. So we'll offer some poll results in just a little bit. But first, this is where all this started. Max Kellerman from the First Take show on ESPN talking about the Indians logo, which led to him going after the Fighting Irish name and the Leprechaun mascot. Again, this is courtesy of ESPN.
When I go to Native American reservations around the country to call fights, I am approached. I've received feathers in honor and letters saying thank you for your stance publicly. This is the way many of us feel. So The Washington Post, do I believe that's a representative survey of the way Native Americans actually feel about this? No, I do not. But how hard is it for you or anyone to empathize, simply empathize with a group who is defended, even if it is a minority of the group that is offended? And as to the argument, kind of when is enough or when does it end? My friend Brian Kenny, Stephen A., our colleague and good friend from ESPN, now on MLB Network, was tweeting about this last night. Someone asked him about, what about the Fighting Irish? Brian is Irish-American. His father, Charlie Kenny, the late, great Charlie Kenny, bog farmer from Ireland, that's where his people are from, walked the beat in Queens as a cop once he got to this country, was asked about the Fighting Irish and the leprechaun logo. And many Irish-Americans are not offended, but many are. And should that also change?
You answer
the answer
that.
The answer is yes, unequivocally yes. Pernicious, negative stereotypes of marginalized people that offend even some among them should be changed. It's not that hard.
Max Kellerman's take on ESPN's First Take, and you heard the groans from the other two individuals on the program when he said that the Fighting Irish name of the mascot should go away. There was the, oh. So, I'm not sure this is a story or not.
I don't think it is, but it's interesting that we're talking about it.
It's brought the conversation to many people. People are writing stories about this. Let me just say this. I started the poll today, and this is Notre Dame country. People that follow me are Notre Dame fans, so I'm not surprised by the voting. But 96% of the people that voted today said this is all ridiculous. 4% said it's worth considering. So we have gone through many changes in athletics in terms of nicknames. Miami, Ohio, St. John's. Now, Illinois didn't have to change
Marquette.
Illinois didn't have to change Fighting Illini, but the very popular Chief Illiniwic mascot, which was a student who was dressed up in Illiniwic uniforms. It shouldn't be uniform. Their dress, I guess, is the best way to put it. And there was a time where the Illiniwic tribe put forth the attire for that person to wear. So they were all in favor of it. That tribe is now gone. So cousins' tribes were the ones that threw the fit over Chief Illiniwic. And with the pressure of the NCAA, Chief Illiniwic went away. And there was just a controversy about this person who still dresses up as Chief Illiniwic shows up, and a professor privately videotaped or audio taped a bathroom conversation, trying to figure out if employees were in on allowing this guy to get in the building. I mean, that's kind of where we are with the ridiculousness of that situation. So, Eric,
wait, I got to stop you right there. I'm amazed that those would be bathroom conversations.
Well, because
mine usually is, hey, we're out of something.
If we were in a larger market, I would go a different direction.
Okay.
But we're in a smaller market, so let's keep it fun and joyful. No, the professor was trying to catch people talking about who allowed this to happen. And he got arrested, actually, for this, and I'm not sure where it's going to go. But, Eric, you heard the argument. I've never come across anyone of Irish descent that is upset about the name being used, the mascot that is used. I'm sure there are some. I know Brian Kenny of the MLB Network has thrown a fit over this in the past, and Max actually referenced Brian in his comments. Are we getting to the point where all nicknames just need to be animals and we can go on with our lives rather than dealing with this? I mean, I'm shocked we're having this conversation about the Fighting Irish.
What if the animals are offended? And they do have people that profess to be able to speak to the animals, right? Besides Dr. Doolittle.
Dionne Warwick on line two.
Yeah,
she's got a giraffe that would like to talk.
Here's the thing. I think this is really kind of a reflection of a slow news day in nationally.
Super Bowl week, and they got to do this?
Yeah, and how connected we are these days that this guy goes off on Notre Dame. You know, I try not to dismiss anything without giving it some thought, and I did give it some thought. And, you know, I did my Ancestry DNA thing the other day, and I found out I'm only 33% Norwegian, not 50% like I thought. But I, you know, should I be offended about the Vikings having horns and stuff? I mean, he said there are a lot of Irish people that are offended by this. You know, Darren, I've been covering Notre Dame for a couple of decades now.
Career politicians put jobs in Mexico.
I can't remember one person saying, you know what, that logo or the nickname is offensive. I think a lot of Irish people take pride in it, that it means they're spirited, and I think they really like it quite a bit. So I don't, you know, I would like to know where he's getting the data that there are a lot of Irish people offended. I would like to see that. And if somebody wants to call in and is of Irish descent.
Absolutely.
Or if they're of Norwegian descent and are upset with the Vikings, you know, I'd like to kind of hear it. But and I do think we need to be sensitive to things that maybe we weren't sensitive 10 or 20 years ago. But this one just baffles me. And he was so passionate about it. So
I was half listening. Our computer just kind of went off on its own and started playing spots, so I was trying to fix the problem. I'm sure you were brilliant in with what you were saying, so I apologize for being distracted there trying to fix a problem here in the studio. But I, again, growing up in Illinois, the whole Chief Illini, I think, is very sensitive to me. I thought it was a ridiculous conversation. There was nothing in disrespect to that Indian tribe that doesn't even exist anymore. That's the thing that really bothered me. It was the cousin tribe, the one that was causing all the problems. So I just think a mascot is a mascot. Now, if there is something that is disrespectful, then absolutely get rid of it. But there is nothing disrespectful about the leprechaun running around the football stadium. We just recently had, for the first time, a leprechaun on skates at a hockey game. Now, it had a gold helmet on, so that was kind of an odd look. We need to figure out a green hat helmet for the leprechaun, but I just can't believe we're having this conversation about the Fighting Irish. Now,
I don't know that
St. John's Redmen, that's maybe a different conversation, but
yeah, I don't know that anybody's having that conversation other than Max Kellerman, though. I mean, has anybody really picked that up and run with it and said, you know what, he's right, or is it just a guy that was trying to get some attention on television one day?
Maybe, because there has never been a serious push from anyone trying to make this a big deal. Now, Brian Kelly has talked about it in the past, and he's got Irish in his blood, and he's found it very offensive to his family. I've listened to his argument. I don't understand the argument.
Brian Kelly?
Brian Kenny.
Oh, Kenny.
If I said
okay.
Kelly, I meant to say Brian
okay.
Kenny,
okay.
Who's of MLB Network.
Okay.
So, he was all fired up about this on Twitter once Kellerman brought it up, basically supporting him in going down this road. I don't think this is going to last long. I think it's a stretch.
I think it's not going to last past 5:20 in our market.
So I've got 38 seconds to fill before we get to that particular moment. Well, it's been... I like to listen. I like to be open to ideas. I like to have my mind changed, but there was nothing in those comments that even struck a chord. I think he's really going down a road where he's going to run into a dead end, and I just don't think he has a strong enough argument. Give us the data and the proof that there is such chaos developing with the name and the mascot being used. Until then, see you later.
Yeah, I mean,
go back to talking about LeBron and the Cowboys.
Even if we want to go back to the Native American thing, you know, I don't know that that's universal either. I know with Florida State and the Seminoles that there is
they're great support.
They're very supportive of it. They really like the image of the Seminole and being part of the Florida State culture and so forth. So,
I don't understand not wanting to be recognized.
You know what? You know who should really be, who I think should be more offended than anybody? The Presbyterian Blue Hose.
Man, now I'm not going to say it.
No, don't go there.
This is the second time this half hour I really wanted to say something.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see if we can find some people that are disgruntled about the name being used at Presbyterian. We'll see if we can find someone. We'll send someone on the streets to...
All right. One of us has to talk here or we're going to have dead air.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm sorry I brought that up.
Ride the hot player.
Okay, moving right along. You want to talk about Durham Smythe for a
Absolutely.
Minute?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about good old Durham Smythe. He, former Irish football player, got the chance to play in the Senior Bowl, had a touchdown catch in the game, and Mike Varell, your colleague at the South Bend Tribune, wrote an article on Durham Today, South Bend Tribune, IndyInsider.com, and Mike was able to talk to NFL DraftScout.com's Dane Brugler about Smythe. And let me just read the quote from Brugler in Mike Varell's story that's, again, in the South Bend Tribune, IndyInsider.com. Quote, "He might not be the fastest out there or the biggest, but he is very consistent. I think he is a well-rounded player. He's more of a one-speed type, a route runner, but he's deliberate in his movements. You can tell he pays attention to the details. I think he's consistent catching the football. He did a nice job in traffic. A lot of times the defender was right on him, and the quarterback made a tight window throw, but he was able to secure it. He has the ability in traffic to stay focused and out-physical defensive backs," end quote. That's from Mike Varell's article. Dane Brugler from NFLDraftScout.com. His thoughts on former Fighting Irish tight end Durham Smythe. But we mentioned for the last couple of years, one of the more unheralded players on this football team. You probably wouldn't know it, but he had a wonderful year this year for this Fighting Irish football team. Did a lot of the dirty work along the line with inline blocking. And you know what? When the ball got to him and it was in his area, he caught the ball. The ball didn't hit the ground around Durham Smythe this year. A very underrated football player on this team. And with the great running game and the great left side of the offensive line, a lot of people got left in the dust in terms of recognition, probably. They deserve more than they got this year, and Smythe is one of those individuals. But he's the guy that's going to be drafted, and I think he might have a chance to be a mid-round draft pick with the way things are going right now for Durham Smythe.
Yeah, the one thing about Durham was he got better every year, and he also... You know, you had Alize Mack on the roster, and he was really kind of able to hold him off and be the more complete of those players. Now, Mack may have a dynamic 2018, and I think Brian Kelly and Chip Long would certainly welcome that. But Durham was able to do everything. He was able to block. He was able to route run. He was a great leader for the team. So I could see him. I could see somebody taking a flyer on him in the NFL and not as a undrafted free agent. I think he definitely will get drafted.
Probably the type of player that's not going to be a go-to tight end on a roster.
Right.
But when you go two tight end sets, or if you need a very solid backup on your roster, Durham Smythe's going to be a very handy player to have around. I don't think he's going to go into the classification of a Tyler Eifert or an Anthony Fasano or a Kyle Rudolph, who were or have been featured tight ends for their respective teams. But this is going to be a very dependable player to have on your football team. He's going to be good around the goal line as a second tight end. I don't know if he's going to be able to help you on special teams in any type of coverage teams. Who knows? But I'll tell you what, Eric, he is really, really good inline blocking. That's not something that shows up in box scores and probably doesn't get rewarded enough for the job he did for this football team.
I think these were done prior to the Senior Bowl. And getting invited to the Senior Bowl is a big deal if you're someone like Durham Smythe that's not a high-round draft choice. But Todd McShay's most recent ranking of tight ends had him as the 10th tight end. And I could see him maybe moving up the list a little bit. The best one in the country is the kid from South Dakota State, Dallas Goedert, I think is how you pronounce his last name. Mark Andrews of Oklahoma got a lot of All-America attention. Those would be the top two. And a guy I really like, Troy Fumagalli, is number 7. But Durham Smythe being in the top 10, that's significant, and that's a good spot to be.
Well, in today's football, everybody is looking for the detached tight end, the athletic basketball player. type tight end that you can line up on the outside as a mismatch. Travis Kelce of Kansas City, Antonio Gates for many years for the San Diego Chargers. So Durham's not that type of player, but he's going to be really good lined up next to a tackle. Eric and Darren with you. It is 26 minutes after the top of the hour. Mari joins us, wants to go back to the Max Kellerman comments here on WSBT Radio. Mari, how are you this evening?
Surviving in this crazy weather.
Good for you. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, listening to you guys and hearing him, he's off the wall. I'm sorry. Yeah. He's just waiting to sum this up. If he wants to change the Fighting Irish name, well, then I'm upset with having a baseball team called the Cubs and a football team called the Colts. That's animal cruelty then.
There you go.
I mean, I'm just thinking about this. What's going on with these people nowadays?
Those are the type of shows where I think they just have to get attention. There are other shows now that have been created like First Take, so they're battling for people's eyes and ears, and I'm just assuming this is just one of those wild takes. Maybe he's passionate about it. Maybe I'm totally wrong on that, but I just can't believe strongly this is going to pick up any steam.
Well, I think he escaped from the nut farm. I mean, I'm sorry to sound that way, but it just, you know, some of the stuff that's gone on with these teams lately and everything cracks me up. They've been called, you know, the Washington Redskins for years. Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish for God knows how long. You know, and now all of a sudden we got to change it.
We've become a very sensitive society. And
yeah,
it's not going to go back the other way. But I think it'll be fine. They're going to be the Fighting Irish. Should we bring back the Irish Terrier? Is that going to make Terrier families very upset that a dog might be used for crying out loud?
Cruelty again. There we go.
Well, I think
it'd be animal cruelty with that. You know, we're going to have to leave it with what we have.
I tell you what, Mari.
Leprechaun's dressed right.
Yeah. Well, look at Uga, the Georgia mascot. He's got an air conditioner in his doghouse. So how many dogs have it any better than him? I don't think he's getting too bad of a shake in the deal. I mean, an air conditioner in the doghouse, that's living the high life.
True. Very true. And wasn't it Navy years ago that used to have the goat out on the field with them, the ram?
They still do have the goat. He's just not allowed to come to Notre Dame Stadium because no live mascots.
Ooh.
But they can bring the fake goat.
Yes. That's right.
Anyways, all I got to say is you guys do a really good job.
Mari, we thank you for listening, and thanks for phoning in.
No problem. Thank you.
Have a good evening. Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser, Michiana sports leader, 96.1 FM WSBT. Don't forget tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, another installment of the Mike Bray Radio Show live from O'Rourke's, and it will be live at 7 on 96.1 FM WSBT. When we come back, more football talk, but we're going to focus on the National Football League. The first domino fell as teams search for their next quarterback. A trade was made, and eventually the dominoes could fall in effect. Former Irish quarterback Deshaun Kizer. We'll talk about that storyline next as Sports Beat continues on 96.1 FM WSBT.
Take us with you in and out of the car. Download the free WSBT radio app from the iTunes or Droid App Store. Listen live anywhere.
Your home of Super Bowl 52, 96.1 FM WSBT. If you're out and about on Sunday, plenty of coverage coming your way, including the opening kickoff at 6:30. The NFC champion Philadelphia Eagles, the underdog, taking on the defending champion and winners of the AFC crown, the New England Patriots. Super Bowl 52, Sunday at 6:30 on 96.1 FM WSBT. Friday's program, Eric and I are switching roles. The advantage game, Super Bowl 52 style, but you get to be Wink Martindale.
All right.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, sure. I'll be Wink.
We'll break it all down, at least our thoughts, and what'll happen in Super Bowl 52. Still waiting to see if Rob Gronkowski will be able to play. Still in concussion protocol. The Patriots tight end has been practicing with the Patriots, but not cleared as of yet. Chances are he'll be ready to go. And the Patriots pool reporter today says that Tom Brady did not have any gloves on today, just a piece of black tape on the hand that had the stitches when he was cut by a helmet before the AFC title game. So things all starting to fall into place for those Patriots as they get set to take on the Philadelphia Eagles in Super Bowl number 52. Well, the Cleveland Browns are a little ways away from getting to their first Super Bowl. 0-16 this year. DeShone Kizer, the former Irish quarterback, played a lot of football for the Browns this year. And unfortunately for Cleveland, they could not even win a single game. And they have won, what, one game the last couple of years? It's not been a lot of fun in Cleveland, but Hugh Jackson is still the head coach. They brought in former Steelers offensive coordinator Todd Haley to call the plays on the offensive side of the football. The Browns are in a very interesting spot. In the first round, they have the first overall pick. And due to a trade with Houston during the draft last year, in which the Texans moved up to take Clemson quarterback DeShone Watson, the Texans lost Watson to injury, and they lost J.J. Watt and a couple other key players, and they struggled. The Texans had the fourth overall pick, but due to that trade before the draft, Cleveland has that pick, so they have number one and number four. So they have over $100 million in cap space. Supposedly, they were involved in trying to acquire Alex Smith from Kansas City. You probably have heard that last night, even though the trade is not official for a little while, the Chiefs are trading their starting quarterback, Alex Smith, to the Washington Redskins. You talk about a politically incorrect trade. There you go. The Chiefs and the Redskins in a trade. Smith also gets a four-year extension and is under Redskin control for 5 years. Now, the Chiefs are going to go with Patrick Mahomes at quarterback, their first-round pick last year out of Texas Tech. So that means Redskins starting quarterback Kirk Cousins out of Michigan State is looking for a new place to play football. The last 2 years received the franchise tag. The Redskins obviously did not believe in Cousins. They never gave him the long-term deal. And had they franchise tagged him again this year, over $34 million would have went into the bank account of Kirk Cousins. But now he is a free agent, and he is going to draw a lot of interest. I mentioned the Browns have the most available cap room. They have over $100 million. But can they entice Cousins to come to that particular situation? The Browns probably are interested. Others that appear to be the favorite in many of the NFL insiders' minds, the Denver Broncos and the New York Jets. Other possibilities, Buffalo, Miami, Arizona, and a wild card could be the Minnesota Vikings with Teddy Bridgewater coming back from injury. Case Keenum was their guy most of the season after Sam Bradford went down with another injury. You cannot count on Sam Bradford. The injury bug seems to get him each and every year. So this quarterback draft and the free agents available could affect DeShone Kizer in Cleveland. Eric, he was the starter, did not have the greatest personnel around him. The one negative that you can't blame on personnel, he made a lot of mistakes in the red zone, made a lot of mistakes this year leading to turnovers, and that is going to lose a lot of football games. Didn't help his left tackle, Joe Thomas, one of the best to ever play that position. First time he had ever been injured and missed a snap, let alone miss games. He was lost, and they did not have him maybe the last month, a month and a half of the season. So as you evaluate DeShone Kizer, is he a guy you think Cleveland can bank on for their future? Or because they have two high picks, and if there is a quarterback they like, don't they almost have to invest in one of those guys just because they have been searching for that guy they can put in the starting lineup for 10 years or so?
As I'm trying to read between the lines on all these moves, I know that the Alex Smith deal means Kirk Cousins is out there for Cleveland and everybody else. And they are the favorites to land him, in part, you mentioned, because of that big cap room.
But does he want to go there?
Well,
that's
a huge question. He was interviewed about that, and winning is important, and they would have to really convince him that they'd be able to surround him with a great supporting cast using their five picks in the first two rounds to be able to do that and sign some free agent wide receivers as well. The thing about that then is, if you're going to commit to Cousins, then it would seem like that is actually a better place for Kizer to be, because then you could be an apprentice kind of guy and maybe take over that role at some point. And it would seem less likely that they would spend one of those five draft picks on another quarterback if they're going to commit to Cousins. The thing about it was, Darren, when they were in the Alex Smith sweepstakes and offered one of those second-round draft choices, they did not sound like they were interested in signing him to an extension as Washington did. So, you know, if they draft over Deshaun, you know, it would seem like why would Cleveland want him then at that point? But the fact that they're looking at a veteran quarterback may be a good sign for Deshaun. It's kind of early to tell. I've been trying to read up on the from the Browns beat writers and columnists and so forth. And again, the fact that they had interest in Alex Smith, I think, is pretty interesting.
Well, it tells the story of their impressions of Deshaun Kizer at this time.
If you're Cleveland, though, if you're not spending one of those picks first and fourth round, you could trade down out of that first spot,
sure,
and get more picks and surround Kirk Cousins and Kizer with more quality players. And you think about, you know, the guys that would be, you know, Barkley is one of the guys that are tossed around. Saquon Barkley at number four, Minkah Fitzpatrick, the cornerback slash safety from Alabama. I mean, you could get some pretty good players if you could parlay that number one pick into maybe multiple first round picks or so. I mean, they're definitely not going to Deshaun and saying, you're our guy of the future. But there are scenarios where he could be the guy of maybe the more distant future. And I think that's was the best scenario in the first place, was him being able to learn from a veteran quarterback before he had to get thrown in there when he wasn't, you know, ready and didn't have the surrounding cast to be able to carry a team at this point.
Eric, Kirk Cousins has done very well in the National Football League. He's 29 years old. He's made a lot of money. The franchise tag he's got from Washington has set him up financially. And if he wants to break the bank, if he wants to be the highest paid quarterback in the National Football League, then he should go to the Cleveland Browns because they probably have the most to offer. Matthew Stafford of the Lions, 5 years, $135 million. That's the deal he signed last offseason, richest contract for a quarterback in NFL history. 60.5 of the 135 is guaranteed. That's really as important as the 135 number in itself. Cousins likely is going to get more than that because it is supply and demand, and there are so many teams looking for quarterbacks. I mentioned teams that could be interested. I want to say Jacksonville, but they already went out there and took the option off the table for Bortles and gave it to him, and he's coming off wrist surgery now, so they could still upgrade, but I would say it's probably not very likely. But Cousins is going to probably get more than Matthew Stafford. And you just think about other quarterbacks, how this could affect them. Think about two elite quarterbacks that are ready to have their big paydays because their contracts are running out. If you're in the ownership group of the Atlanta Falcons and the Green Bay Packers, you got to be sweating what Cousins could get. If Cousins tops Stafford's numbers, you've got Matt Ryan of the Falcons, Eric, with 1 year left on his deal. Aaron Rodgers, or as John Gruden would say, Aaron Rodgers of the Green Bay Packers has 2 years left on his deal. And it gets down to, well, if Kirk Cousins gets ... then Matt Ryan and Aaron Rodgers should get many more dots than Kirk Cousins. So this is going to have a huge effect not only on Cousins and the quarterback market of teams looking for quarterbacks now, it even affects some teams that have quarterbacks like Atlanta and Green Bay. They know they're going to have to pay up, but Cousins could really push that number into a different stratosphere. And I have a feeling Cousins could make $30 million a year out of this because you've got the Jets who have been looking for what they believe is a franchise quarterback for many, many years. How many times have they swung and missed? You take a look at Cleveland. They're in the same boat. It's a long time since Bernie Kosar was behind center for the Cleveland Browns. And many people within the locker room and in the organization in Denver believe they're a quarterback away from being ready to push once again for a Super Bowl. As a Bronco fan, I would need a couple of more offensive linemen to help that get there, but they feel like Cousins would put them over the top. This is going to be a $30 million quarterback. If Kirk Cousins is $30 million, then you can probably figure out what Matt Ryan and Aaron Rodgers might be able to get when their contracts run out with their respective teams. So, to me, Eric, if Cousins wants to truly break the bank, the Cleveland Browns give him the best opportunity to do so. I don't want to be one of those individuals and say, why do you want to go to Cleveland? Because you know what? Cleveland's trying to build something, and eventually they're going to find footing, they're going to build a foundation, and they're going to become competitive. But I think there is something to be said. If Cousins wants to take a little less money and go to a couple of places where he would have a chance to win a Super Bowl right away, then you'd have to say his agent should be contacting the Minnesota Vikings and the Denver Broncos. Those are the two spots that can get you to the postseason quicker than any of these teams. Now, maybe the Bills would be a team. They snuck into the playoffs this year. I would have to say they might be on the list. But come on, if you're not going to go for the biggest contract, if you're not going to go to Cleveland, then Denver and Minnesota makes a lot of sense for Kirk Cousins. And then it comes down to Cleveland, like you just documented. If they don't want to go quarterback in the draft, which I think they'd have to if they don't get a free agent, this really sets up the Giants and the Colts as well, who sit at 2-3. Imagine if the Browns take someone other than a quarterback at number one. Then the Giants have the pick of the litter. They want a quarterback. The Colts don't. So if the Browns don't take quarterback at one, the Giants will take a quarterback at two, and all of a sudden the Colts are going to have all these teams throwing draft picks at them for that number three spot to get the second best quarterback on their board. This whole thing, I think if Kirk Cousins goes to Cleveland, the Indianapolis Colts are going to be extremely happy, because either the Browns are going to take a non-quarterback, or then again they may trade out and somebody else comes in and takes a quarterback. But I think the Colts are sitting in a very, very good spot right now. The Browns could really decide how good a spot they're in. But this is going to be quite fascinating for DeShone Kizer. I think the fact they went in search of Alex Smith, trying to bring him aboard, tells you they're not so sure that he's the best quarterback right now for that team. So one way or the other, DeShone Kizer is going to be the backup, I think, for the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah.
And he's just going to have to wait for an injury or an ineffective play in order to get on the football field. He just didn't help himself, Eric. There's a time and a point where, even though the talent around you may not be the best, sometimes a quarterback just has to make plays on his own, and sometimes a quarterback just has to look special at times. And he had his moments, but I don't think they saw enough from him where he was able to take talent and rise them up to another level to get them even more competitive in 2017. So I think that probably hurt him, and the turnovers obviously did not help him.
Turnovers were...
killed him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put him in a tough spot. So the carousel begins. Alex Smith to the Redskins. Cousins is a free agent. Bears fans are hoping we don't have to worry about being on that carousel for a while with Mitchell Trubisky as the Bears starting quarterback, and of course Colts football on WSBT radio this fall. Every Colts game on 96.1 FM WSBT. Andrew Luck supposedly will be ready for 2018, and after Super Bowl 52, it appears Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels will take over as the Colts head coach. A lot of drama still to come, even with Super Bowl 52 around the corner. The free agency, the draft with all these quarterbacks, it will be quite interesting, and we'll see how it affects DeShone Kizer. 12 minutes in front of the top of the hour. My five question of the day is next. Eric came up with today's question. It is a doozy. The top five assistant coaches at Notre Dame during the Brian Kelly era. Lot to choose from. Brian Van Gorder met the media today as Louisville defensive coordinator. He says he has no regrets from his time at Notre Dame. He's not speaking for the rest of us. I don't know.
And the question is, can you keep winning? I don't know.
Thank you, Lou, very much. We'll get to the My Five question of the day next. Sports Beat, brought to you by Budweiser on Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT. Abby, thank you. I'll get my mic on the third time I push the button. Board's having a rough day today. We may have to put
it
on the disabled list.
We're thanking her for a low of 14 in lake effect snow. Okay.
This forecast brought to you by EatDrinkDTSB.com. Support Beacon Children's Hospital. Dine local during Winter Restaurant Week.
One question, five answers. This is the My Five Question of the Day on Michiana's Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Very interesting question today. The top five assistant coaches at Notre Dame during the Brian Kelly era. How many coaches do you have to choose from?
24. Well, you wanted me to say 9, didn't you?
No, that's okay. That means 19 are not on the list. We'll go 5-1 with number one being the assistant coach in Eric's opinion that is the best during the Brian Kelly era. We begin with number five.
It was easy to get from 24 down to 12. There were some one-year guys like Mike Elko made a tremendous impact in 1 year, both on recruiting and on the defense. But he did not make the list. And this took into account recruiting and player development, things of that nature, impact. So I went with number five, who I think was one of the best, if not the best, recruiters of the Brian Kelly era, and that's Tony Alford. He left after the 2014 season, I believe, to go to Ohio State. He was coach wide receivers at first for Brian Kelly, the lone holdover from the Charlie Weiss era. Really got recruiting off to a great start for Brian when Brian was an unproven recruiter at this level and his whole staff was instead of Alford. So Tony Alford's number five.
Got a job promotion to go to Ohio State. Number four.
Number four, Chuck Martin, who also left for a promotion to be head coach at Miami, Ohio, which did change its nickname at some point. And why he gets the nod over Bob Diaco is he coached on both sides of the ball, did a great job as a DB's coach. He was the offensive coordinator during the 2012 run that was to the national championship game, which is actually fueled by the defense. But Diaco wasn't a good recruiter. And I think Martin brought a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. He was a decent recruiter and certainly a very good player developer.
Top five assistant coaches at Notre Dame during the Brian Kelly era. Number three.
I think some people will be surprised by this one, and I could have made a case to put him higher, but it's Mike Denbrock. When you look at offensive play callers who exceeded the points that their teams typically scored, he was at 88.5%. The next closest is Chip Long and at 77%. Mike Denbrock faced 65% of the defenses he faced in his 26-game run were top third defenses. Nobody else was above 45%. Top 10 defenses, almost 20%. He was a great recruiter, a really good developer of wide receivers. He could coach any position on the offense. I think because people know that Brian and Mike were longtime associates, that was a ding against him. But I think he's a tremendous coach.
Number two.
The one assistant that is still on Brian Kelly's staff from the very beginning, and it's Mike Elston. And I think Mike Elston has been a tremendous position coach, whatever position he was coaching, whether it was defensive line or linebackers. You think about the 2012 team, they had some very good talent, but he was able to bring that out of some younger players like Stephon Tuitt and Lewis Nix, whose motor wasn't always on, hasn't been in the NFL to this point. And he's also, when Tony Alford left, he became a dynamic recruiting coordinator. He's always been a good recruiter. He held this team together after Brian Van Gorder was fired, not only in recruiting, but in coordinating the defense. So Mike Elston is my number two.
Top five assistant coaches at Notre Dame during the Brian Kelly era. Alford 5, Martin 4, Denbrock 3, Elston 2, and I know who number one is then.
Number one is Harry Hiestand, the offensive line coach, came aboard for the 2012 season, won the Joe Moore Award with his group this past season. He will be the Chicago Bears offensive line coach next year. Harry was a sniper in recruiting. He didn't recruit a whole lot of kids from other positions, but he could spot talent. And I think the best example of that is Quentin Nelson, a five-star, next to Mike McGlinchey, a low four-star guy that wasn't even a top 240 to a top 250 player. They're both going to be first-round draft choices.
That is today's My 5 Question of the Day. Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Here's Eric Hansen with what's coming up in tomorrow's South Bend Tribune Sports Section.
Well, Mike Varell has a follow-up story on Notre Dame's most recent verbal commitment, and he'll have that in the paper tomorrow, and that is KJ Wallace. Tyler has a wrap-up of all who Notre Dame is involved in still with recruiting, who might sign, who may go elsewhere. Anthony has a Notre Dame women's basketball advance, and we have a Penn girls, we have the Penn girls basketball sectional action, and much, much more.
We're going to bypass CBS Sports. Normally, we go to CBS Sports at this time. I'm going to keep you just for 2 minutes here because Angelo DiCarlo from WNDU, their sports director, just posted a story about 10 minutes ago. Let me read it and get a reaction from you. Former Notre Dame running back C.J. Holmes could have shoplifting charges against himself dismissed by July if he stays out of trouble. Holmes was arrested in December for allegedly stealing a coat at Macy's at UP Mall in Mishawaka. And in Angelo's story, it says that the St. Joseph County Prosecutor's Office says the diversion agreement is pretty standard for nonviolent offender right. with little or no criminal history. Freshman running back for the Fighting Irish this year recently was kicked off the football team by Brian Kelly. Do you believe this could open the door for a return for C.J. Holmes?
I think it depends on what Notre Dame's disciplinary arm thinks about this, because we don't know if C.J. Holmes had been in trouble at the university for something else before. But this is certainly a good sign, especially if he's able to live up to that standard.
Okay, so that report, courtesy of Angelo DiCarlo, WNDU, C.J. Holmes could have his shoplifting charges against him dismissed if he stays out of trouble. Eric, we'll talk to you tomorrow. Sports Beat will get back going once again in just a couple of moments on 96.1 FM, WSBT.
Michiana's sports leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT presents Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat.
Booger, up and in! With 2 seconds left, Notre Dame leads!
Malpas again, backhands, he scores!
Down to the corner, Jablonski, 3 is good!
Andrew steps in, he's going to throw deep for T.Y., he's got it!
Flips to Jenkins, 3 for the win, it's good! Villanova wins it!
He tied, it is a touchdown! New England wins!
Adios! Cubs win their 9th in a row!
Miles Boykin is in the end zone! The Irish have come back!
Here are your hosts, Darren Pritchett and Sean Stiers.
Sports Beat rolls on. Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM. WSBT, we are presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some Buds. Sean Stiers, Darren Pritchett with you this hour. Coming up in just a couple of moments, we'll talk to Alan Karpik from Gold and Black Illustrated. He is the president and publisher of that Purdue Boilermaker publication. A lot to talk about with the Boilermakers rolling right now, having won 17 consecutive games, including, going back to last year, 12 in a row in the Big Ten Conference, and they will take on the Maryland Terrapins at Mackey Arena at 8:30 tonight. So we'll talk to Alan in just a couple of moments. Bottom of this hour, Tom Uziak, minor league correspondent for the Cubs Den, will begin a series of interviews on Cubs prospects. We'll focus on minor league outfielders today. And as we start this hour, we'll get things going the way we wrapped up last hour. And this report from WNDU sports director Angelo DiCarlo, he is reporting on the WNDU.com website that former Notre Dame running back C.J. Holmes could have shoplifting charges against him dismissed by July if he stays out of trouble. Holmes was charged with conversion, a Class B misdemeanor, because he was arrested for allegedly stealing a coat from UP Mall in Mishawaka. And Angelo is reporting that the St. Joseph County Prosecutor's Office says the diversion agreement is pretty standard for nonviolent offender with little or no criminal history. So the charges could be dismissed at his next scheduled hearing on July 2nd. Keep in mind that recently Holmes, a freshman running back, was kicked off the Notre Dame football team by Fighting Irish head coach Brian Kelly. And as Eric mentioned at the end of last hour, that we'll have to see if the university is going to allow him back in. But there is an outside chance that C.J. Holmes could be at least out of trouble in the criminal world if everything goes well between now and July. And we'll have to see if he ever puts on that Notre Dame football helmet once again.
Yeah, and would be an interesting little twist here, especially considering the issues that the running back position now has with depth, with both he and Deion McIntosh being dismissed, and obviously Josh Adams headed to the NFL. It's a position of need. I think the main thing is he needs to make sure that he gets himself figured out. I'm sure that's going to be a big part of whether or not, one, he is still with the school, and two, with the football team next year.
Well, speaking of football, it was a fun year for Purdue Boilermaker fans as Jeff Rom really turned around that Purdue football program. And now the basketball team, Matt Painter's squad, number 3 in the nation, 17 consecutive victories, 12 straight wins in the Big Ten dating back to last year. Those last two numbers are school records, and they return to action tonight at 8:30 at Mackey Arena to take on the Maryland Terrapins, who are in desperate need of a quality victory. They are 15-8, 4-6 in the Big Ten, and not a lot of quality victories on their NCAA tournament resume. So a big one for Maryland tonight, and Purdue just looks to keep the train rolling right along, as they are 10-0 in the Big Ten Conference. Joining us is Alan Karpik, the president and publisher of Gold and Black Illustrated. They talk all things Boilermaker sports down in West Lafayette. Alan, it's Darren Pritchett. Good to catch up with you. How are you today?
Darren, if you're a Purdue fan or covering Purdue sports, it is a good time. You talk about Jeff Brohm and what he's done, kind of raised all the spirits of this program. But Matt Painter's crew is almost taking it to another level. It's borderline euphoric around West Lafayette just because of, you know, it's not every day that Purdue's ranked third in the country in anything, and this is a very unique and fun basketball team to watch.
Alan, you turn on various networks. The analysts talk about Purdue's got an excellent chance to win the national championship. I'm sure Boilermaker fans get a little tense when they hear that, just because they've been so close to Final Fours the last couple of decades, haven't been there since 1980. But take me back to the moment you knew Caleb Swanigan was going to leave school early for the NBA draft. Did you believe a run like this was possible with the group left behind?
No, I mean, in all honesty, I mean, I didn't think that this team would be a top 5 team. I mean, I thought it was fair that they were, you know, in the top 20. I think they were 21st to start the season and all of that. But I think that what maybe was the first indicator was the fact in Purdue's trip to Taiwan and the fact that the Boilermakers in the World University Games, though they didn't win it, they played so well. And I can remember the Israel game and what a classic basketball game that was. It was just like a Big Ten game, and Carson Edwards, I think, had 36 points, and Purdue had to make great plays down the stretch to win. And I thought, you know, this is a unique group. This has been such a close unit. You know, this group of seniors, you know, Purdue was two years before these guys got here, Purdue fans don't want to think about. They finished last in the Big Ten. And the other year they finished with a losing record. This is a group that will go down in history as really be the ones that and the four seniors that have brought Purdue basketball back. And now, if you're, I don't care who you are, if you're a Purdue fan, if you're just a fan of college basketball, you have to give those guys respect for what they've done, because I don't know if this is a national championship team, but I do know that this is a team that's been terrific to watch, and I would be surprised. Someone's going to have to beat them. I just don't think this is a team that's going to beat itself. It has enough different weapons that it will be very interesting come March, and hopefully for Purdue even in that first couple days of April.
Alan, I saw a quote from you online today where you were referring to this team as possibly the best team in Purdue history, and it just kind of give us some perspective of that, and then maybe like what was the next best team? How long do you have to go back to what you think maybe was the best team prior to this year?
Well, contrary to popular belief, I was not alive in 1932 when John Wood was, they were 17-1, and you know, you go to the banners, and Indiana fans get kind of have fun with Purdue because you know, IU has the five national championship banners, and Purdue has its one in 1932, which is a mythical national championship with John Wooden at the helm at 17-1. And so I can't compare that group, but I can compare them all from 1966 on. Part of me says, you know, I have a hard time saying, oh, this team can't, because there are no sure first-round NBA guys in this team, in my view. They're just such a great blend of players, and that's what's been interesting. But, you know, I think it's been fun to argue. You know, I think the 2010 team with Rob Hummel and Chris Kramer and Keaton Grant and Etuan Moore and Juwan Johnson before Hummel's injury at Minnesota was right at the level of this team. Probably maybe better be a hell of a game between those two. You know, you have to look at Big Dog in 1994 because you had Big Dog. But that team wasn't ranked. It did go to the NCAA tournament ranked third, but it had to work its way up the ladder and did win a Big Ten championship. And I suppose Troy Todd and Everett, 1988 and 87, were right there. That team was ranked in the top five most of the year, certainly most of the second half of the year, and yet didn't get past the Sweet 16. And you go way back to Rick Mountain, 1969, sure, and Billy Keller and Herman Gilliam. Hard to compare those guys. But this is just – it has been a great blend to watch. You can argue the Big Ten's not as good, sure. There are probably only four or five teams at the most that are going to make the NCAA tournament out of this league. But this has been, they're just interesting. They've morphed. They've developed. Isaac Haas has gotten the 7'2" senior center has become a guy that maybe is worthy of being the Big Ten's most valuable player. I mean, that sounds crazy, but what he does and what he brings his team, you know, if Purdue can win the Big Ten championship, he ought to get some consideration, as should Vincent Edwards and Carson Edwards. So they're just a good blend, and they play team basketball. It's probably the most, I will say this, it's probably the most unselfish basketball team I've seen at Purdue. Though I thought Hummel's group back in 2010 was pretty good in that area too, but this is just a very unique team of guys that have not only gotten better, but make the extra pass, and they can shoot the three. And Haas, the way he's been inside, makes Purdue very, very dangerous.
Alan Karpik, president, publisher of Gold and Black Illustrated, talking Boilermaker basketball on WSBT Radio. Alan, I got to admit, I'm a defensive nut. People call me crazy, but I think Virginia basketball is a thing of beauty. I loved Wisconsin with Bo Ryan, and Purdue is terrific in transition defense. They are so solid in the half court. With all that being said, I've always been told, well, if you're an offensive team, you just can't spend all that energy on the defensive side. You got to be one or the other. Purdue is a balanced basketball team. They play hard on offense. They play hard on defense. As you look down the road, and I hate to wish away the regular season, but when you get to March Madness, because this team is so balanced, do you feel like they can compete against any style of basketball, or is there a style that could affect them?
Well, I think you have to look at the Michigan game last week, and Michigan's a very good basketball team. I mean, I know they were only ranked 25th, but I like, you know, that's the kind of team that you might, if you're Purdue, face in the round of 32 that can cause you trouble. And they've caused Purdue trouble, and Purdue beat them by four in Mackey and won by 1 point in a somewhat controversial win in Ann Arbor. And you may see a little bit of that tonight in Maryland's game just because Anthony Cowan's a very, very a guard that for Maryland. I think Purdue, you know, is 15-point favorite tonight, which is almost crazy. But you know, Maryland has struggled some. But I think teams with length that can negate what Haas does or force Haas to do certain things defensively can cause Purdue problems. But then again, they got to defend Haas, and Purdue has figured out how to do that. You're right. You know, even though you gave up 88 points against against Michigan, you say, well, wait, is this team really that good defensively? I thought that was one of the most spectacular college basketball games I'd seen in all my years of going to Purdue games and watching college basketball. Just was a phenomenal game. Purdue has problems at times containing the dribble. There's some of that. They have at times had problems giving up offensive rebounds and in the rebounding game. But you're right. They are fundamentally extremely well-coached defensively, and they're not so athletic that they can suffocate people defensively, but their principles are there that I think you're right. That's why I think I think that even, you know, I have this, the whole talk about Purdue being a national championship contender is because they are that balanced. And I would argue also they're also helped to some extent that on the national landscape, there just does not appear to be somebody that just stands head and shoulders above anybody else in terms of talent. And so therefore a team that's got some balance that plays extremely hard and can play defense the way it does gives Purdue a legitimate chance to win the whole shooting match.
The guy I think I've been the most impressed with when I've watched Purdue this year is Isaac Haas, especially compared to the last couple of years. Where have you kind of watched him grow? Where do you think he's made the most progress over the last couple of years?
Well, I think they've defined. I think on a couple of things. He's been defined. He at times in the past, he's really had a pretty solid career at Purdue. You know, he's had this. He was in tandem with AJ Hammonds. He kind of split time to some extent with Caleb Biggie Swanigan last year, but. He has learned, A, he doesn't travel anymore when he gets the ball in the post. He's efficient in there. He is literally knows that right shoulder move is or left shoulder move, I guess I should say, on the right block is literally unstoppable. And is starting to prove, especially against guys that, you know, Indiana, who played a terrific game against Purdue, when push came to shove down the stretch, they just went to Haas and they couldn't stop him. And yet he's also, I think the games that you have to remember about what he's done were a couple games ago against Iowa and I believe Wisconsin, where he only had 5 shots, and yet Purdue just destroyed Iowa almost in record proportion, leading by 37 on the road at one time because Haas passed the ball efficiently out of the post, and Purdue got 3 after 3 after 3. I mean, they had 5 guys make 3 or more 3-pointers, first time in Purdue history. I don't know if we did the research. I'm not sure how many times that's happened in NCAA annals in terms of having 5 guys do it. That's where he's let the game come to him. He's become an extremely good free throw shooter, you know, shooting 78% or whatever he is. And, you know, he has some deficiencies because he's so huge. People think he shouldn't be able to miss a shot or that he can defend anybody. There's certain guys he can't defend, but they've gone to that in the last 6 minutes or 5 minutes of close games. You know, you see the offense, the defense move that Matt Painter uses with Matt Harms. It's worked very well. And I think that's where you see a guy that's just made great strides as a player, and I'm with you. I think he's been one of the unsung guys. I would argue also number 3, the sophomore Carson Edwards, is a guy that Purdue and not many teams have. He's just so explosive, and I don't know that Purdue's ever had a guy quite like him, just in terms of that explosiveness and also that lack of. I would argue that sometimes as a freshman, I said, "Well, his lack of good sense because he would shoot shots that he shouldn't shoot." He's developed now he's matured into being a very good sophomore. He makes the extra pass, but when he needs to make a shot, he's made them. And in tournament time, he's fearless. He always worries about teams getting nervous and puckering up, as Gene Katie used to say. I think this is a guy that gives you that some of that. He has no conscience as a basketball player. He just plays. And extremely good defensively, and he's got a high motor for running that offense, and it doesn't always have to be. He likes to score, don't get me wrong, but he can now live with a 12-point game when he has 6 assists and Purdue wins by 30. So that's a maturity thing that I think is a very unique thing about where Purdue is right now.
Alan, one thought on the Indiana game. Hostile environment. Arch rival, yeah. They fall behind. I watched that game from buzzer to buzzer, and those Purdue players never blinked. They never panicked. And I'm just wondering where that comes from. Is it the head coach, or is this just a very mentally strong group of players?
Well, I think the 4 seniors helps that. I mean, I think they've been through stuff, and you got to remember, they're freshmen and sophomore years. They blew a 7-point lead in the last minute as freshmen in the NCAA tournament to Cincinnati and lost. They blew a 13-point lead in the last 3 minutes against Little Rock as sophomores and lost. Now, there were other players on that team. I get that. But those guys have experienced that. And that was damn painful. And then for them. And then last year, they got to the Sweet 16 and played Kansas really pretty well for 30 minutes, but then end up losing by 30. And I think that, those factors, the thing I think that they've been is they've been good studies. They've guys that have learned from what they've experienced and have worked their butts off in the gym. I mean, let's be honest here. Dakota Mathias, nobody in the Big Ten offered Dakota Mathias, and he is a as good a college basketball player. I'm not saying he's an NBA guy, but he's extremely good, solid college basketball player that does all the right things. And you got a Vincent Edwards who, you know, only Michigan in the Big Ten was really interested. Ohio State in his own home state wasn't interested in him. You know, these guys have all bled. Isaac Koss, we know about the story of him getting from Wake Forest to Purdue. He was a top 75 high school player. But my point is, they've done it with guys that have experienced difficulty as players. They've had success. They've won a Big Ten championship, but that pain of that freshman and sophomore years, I think, resonates with those guys, and they realize that, and it could, you know, you hope it doesn't happen again, but there's no sign of it happening again. This team has really been mentally tough, mentally mature, and I think you're seeing it on a night-in, night-out basis.
Alan, Matt Painter, he's a Purdue guy, he's an Indiana guy, 13th year now at Purdue, which is amazing to think about that. Wow. I know. But is there any, with all this success that he's having, is there any concern at all that he might look for greener pastures at some point?
I don't know. And, you know, there's still some part of the fan base, not much, and there shouldn't be any, in my opinion, but a guy that, because I talk about those two losses in the NCAA tournament, and there's still some people that say, well, we'll see if he, you know, get him to a Final Four. Well, Purdue hasn't been to the Final Four in 38 years, and Gene Katie was great at coach as he was, never got him to the Final Four. But I don't think so. I think Matt is a guy that, is very comfortable at Purdue, but also the thing I like about Matt Painter that has been a constant of him is that he constantly works at his craft, and I'm talking about recruiting. Now, there are people in Purdue, in the Purdue world, that are critical that Purdue doesn't get typically five-star or McDonald's All-American. Yes, they got Swanigan, but we all know that story came through Michigan State and other things. You know, that's just the nature of Purdue. But what I think Purdue has developed, and I think this group of four seniors shows kids around the country that you can do a lot of pretty special things as a college basketball player and be in a good environment. He's tough-minded. He's stubborn to some extent about doesn't like to play zone defenses and all that stuff. But I think he's to use a psychological term, self-actualizing as a basketball coach is too, because he's just that maturity level. There are some advantages to being around 13 years and adjusting to things that you did well and didn't well, but didn't do well. And Matt Painter is just, for whatever reason, he's got a lot to do. And I think that's the untold story is, you got to give this guy credit because they were down and there were questions about if he'd had a third losing season in a row or at Purdue or a third down year in a row, there were questions about his long term, where he was going to be here. And he turned that around with getting the right kind of kids here. And I think that's the formula that he likes to use. And I think this is a really good fit for him because it allows him. He's an Indiana basketball guy. He respects players that love basketball. You got to love basketball to play here. And maybe that's overstated, but I just don't see that as being a, you know, I won't say the same thing about Jeff Brohm down the road because Jeff Brohm's not from Purdue. His departure from Purdue has been greatly over exaggerated. Jeff Brohm, I think, will be at Purdue for a reasonable amount of time because he wants to build a winner. But before he moves on to his next thing, but I could see Matt Painter being at Purdue for a very, very long time. He already has been, and I wouldn't have said that 7-8 years ago. But I think once the Missouri thing came up in 2011 or whenever that was, and now he's back to having a manageable program. And he still works at it. That's the thing. He hadn't quit working at it. He's not resting on his laurels, so to speak. This guy's still working at it very, very hard, and he knows how competitive it is. And they're not going to be at the same level they were this year, next year, but they're still going to be pretty good basketball basketball team. And he has morphed his style, in my opinion, to making them, you know, he's done a great job of, you know, they kind of, you know, from being a half-court type offense to some extent, they're being slower paced, to being one of the fastest paced, funnest teams to watch in college basketball. And that's a credit to the coaching staff, certainly.
One final question for Al. I've got about a minute here. Which guy do you believe is going to be more dangerous in the Big Ten rebuilding their program? I'll give you two choices. Archie Miller at Indiana or Brad Underwood at Illinois?
Boy, that is a good question. I haven't watched enough of Illinois. I know how good they played defensively, and if I'm Purdue, I'm worried. I'm not worried today, but I'm worried on February 22nd when you go there, because there's something about the way they play defense and scratch and claw that are interesting, but I don't know enough about him and his recruiting. But Archie Miller's going to do a good job at Indiana. I mean, I don't think Matt Painter has talked about, they have a lot of respect, obviously, known him for a long time, and he'll do a great job there and make Indiana very competitive. So I'll hedge and say Archie Miller, only because I know that better. Illinois has always sat on a wealth of talent, and assuming that Underwood can deal with the recruiting side of it and start to get the talent he gets there, Illinois will be just fine, but I'll hedge with Arch Miller.
Okay. Alan, there's a lot of Boilermaker fans in our listening audience. How can they learn more about Gold and Black Illustrated?
GoldenBlack.com. You can go to our site. We're on the Rivals Network, and we have a print. We still have a print and digital magazine as well, and it's a fun time if you're interested in becoming a knucklehead. That's the people on board, named after the late, great Joe Tiller. Can't believe Joe's gone from us, but we have a lot of fun, and this is a fun time to do it. You can't find a better time if you're a Purdue fan. Purdue fans have had to deal with some scorched earth for a few years, especially in football. That has changed with Jeff Brom, I promise you.
Alan, always great to catch up with you. Greatly appreciate your knowledge on Purdue athletics, and we will talk to you down the road.
All right, guys. Always appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks, Al.
Alan Karpik, president, publisher of Gold and Black Illustrated. The latest on the Purdue Boilermakers. They'll host Maryland tonight at 8:30. That game, I believe, on the Big Ten Network. Coming up next, Tom Uziak from the Cubs Den will join us. He'll begin a series of interviews on top Chicago Cubs prospects. Today, we'll focus on outfielders and how many of those top prospects will be in South Bend this year. Answers coming up next on 96.1 FM WSBT. Sean Sayers, Darren Pritchett with you, 24 minutes in front of the top of the hour. South Bend Cubs baseball once again on 96.1 FM WSBT. And, of course, the South Bend Cubs are the Midwest League affiliate of the Chicago Cubs. The last couple of years, Tom Uziak has joined us, minor league correspondent for the Cubs Den, to talk about Cubs prospects. And we begin a series of Wednesday interviews tonight by checking out some of the top prospects in the outfield in the Cubs system. Tom, good to catch up with you. How are you this evening?
I'm doing fine, Darren. It's appropriate that we start talking about outfielders when we learned the sad news today that former Cub Oscar Gamble passed away. So condolences to the Gamble family. Oscar was a great player for many years in the major leagues.
Yeah, had a good run with the White Sox as well. Had 31 home runs one season. I remember his baseball card, the big hair afro outside of the hat. I remember that baseball card like it was yesterday. Well, let's start at the major league level, Tom. It is kind of interesting. Kyle Schwarber, an up-and-down year. Jason Hayward, you're not getting the production you want offensively from him. How does the outfield stack up for 2018, in your opinion?
For the major league level, there's good points and bad points for every one of the outfielders that look to be starters. So that's why I think that one of the keys to how successful the outfielder is going to be is Ian Happ. Happ played both in the outfield and at second base last year, but with having Javier Baez, Ben Zobrist, and Tommy La Stella all being able to play second base, I don't see him playing as much second base this year. And he might be the person in that outfield that gives enough of a break to the rest of the players out there that the Cubs can maximize the potential of all four of them.
I'm curious about Schwarber, Tom, because I've seen all these videos about what good shape he is in and the whole thing. Do you think that Are we expecting too much if we think that he's going to dramatically improve defensively?
Well, there's always hope. That's always a good thing. And it's great to see that he's taking this much effort in order to try to improve himself in the outfield. I don't know whether losing a lot of weight is going to improve anybody's instincts or experience that they've had in the outfield. One thing that you know about Kyle Schwarber is that he's going to give it his all once he's out there. It may not always be pretty, but he's definitely somebody that if he can find his right niche with the Cubs, he's going to be somebody that they can build on for a long period of time.
Tom Uziak from the Cubs Den, our guest, talking about the Chicago Cubs system at the outfield position. Now let's talk about top prospects in the Cubs minor league system. A year ago at this time, we were raving about Eloy Jimenez after that great year with South Bend, but traded in the Jose Quintana deal. And I'm one of those guys. I was in favor of Torres being traded. I understand you have to give up something big to get a controllable, young, cheap starting pitcher in Quintana. So I get you had to give up a lot, but I'm a big Eloy guy. So how different does the prospect list look now without Eloy in this system?
Well, the prospect is long on potential and, short on a lot of star power with this. You know, losing Eloy, losing Billy McKinney the previous year, losing Rashad Crawford the previous year, losing Donny DeWeese in the offseason, the Cubs outfield talent level has gone down a little bit in the minor league system, but you normally look for a couple players, but I'm going to give you three that are out there. We'll start with former South Bend Cub Eddie Julio Martinez. Right now, Eddie was at the Myrtle Beach level last year and kind of showed a little bit stagnant progress in his play. His numbers were quite the same as they were a year before. He played about the same amount of games. He hit the same amount of home runs, 14 home runs. His average didn't get much better. His on-base percentage didn't get much better. But he was also a year up in the system. So we're hoping that as far as what we can see out of Eddie Julio Martinez, that he puts all these things together and is able to fulfill his potential that when the Cubs first signed him and show some of that power up at Double A Tennessee. Got to remember, though, with Eddie Julio Martinez, he's still a very good defensive outfielder and probably has one of the best arms in the entire franchise.
Tom, what about South Bend? Who do you think are the guys who are going to be here at South Bend to start off the season in a couple months?
Oh, well, as far as South Bend goes, the roster is going to be somewhat college experience. There's going to be a lot of that coming in based on what the Cubs drafted last year. The number one player that I'm looking at for South Bend is an outfielder by the name of Chris Carrier. He was selected in the 9th round. He's listed as a right fielder but played a lot of left field last year, too. In 2015, he had a life-saving surgery for a blood clot on him. He wasn't very productive when he came in after signing last year, but scouts rave about his power potential, and you got to like a guy who battles back from surgery like this. Other positions would be, as far as center fielder looks for South Bend, I'm looking at Zach Davis. Zach was drafted in 2016 and decided to take up switch hitting after he was signed. He was pretty productive last year with short season A Eugene. He batted .275 and had 24 stolen bases in 60 games, so he brings a lot of speed and defense into center field. And then for the last position at South Bend, we're looking at another switch hitter that was selected in the 16th round last year. Brandon Hughes, he had a lot of stolen bases when he was in college, 50 stolen bases in his career, played 41 games at Eugene, hit about .250, and stole 6 bases. So you're going to see a lot of experience, a lot of speed, and hopefully a lot of potential run production out of the South Bend outfield to start the season.
Tom Buziak from the Cubs Den talking about Cub prospects. Just to go back to the top outfield prospects in the system, you mentioned Eddie Julio Martinez. Is there another outfielder that you're excited about that could make his way up the system or could be a trade piece down the line?
Well, one of the outfielders that looks primed to be a breakup prospect for the Cubs system this year is another former South Bend Cubs player, Kevante Mitchell. Now, Kevante is 22 years old, but he's a young 22. He didn't play a lot of baseball when he was in high school and is basically learning baseball as a professional. Last year, he played twice as many games as he's ever played baseball before in his life and was able to produce numbers that were an improvement from the year before. He batted .245 for South Bend. He had 11 home runs, leading the team in home runs, and he also was among the leaders in stolen bases with 21 stolen bases. Kevante is one of these athletes that has just got those fast twitch muscles. I've seen him being able to jump over the heads of teammates and everything like that. The big thing with Kevante Mitchell is that he has to start learning to play within the talent that he has and maximize that. Cutting down his strikeouts would be helpful too. He had 108 strikeouts last year, so I'd like to try to improve that a bit. But Kevante Mitchell is somebody that could actually burst onto the scene this year for the Cubs as an outfield prospect.
DJ Wilson spent a lot of time in South Bend last year. He's a guy who kind of came into the organization with a lot of expectations, kind of up and down last year, some of it due to injury. Where do you see him kind of starting out, and what do his prospects look like?
Well, it all depends on how good of a spring training DJ Wilson has. He might end up back in South Bend to start the year, but I think that he's going to end up going to Myrtle Beach eventually during the year. With DJ Wilson, he's got a great speed-power combination. He can steal probably 20 bases. He could be a potential 20-20 or even a 30-30 guy if he plays up to his potential. What the biggest problem with DJ Wilson is that he hasn't been able to settle himself at the plate. He searches for pitches a little bit too much. He tries to do too much at times. He needs to play more within himself. But, you know, like Kevante Mitchell, he's a fantastic athlete. And one of the things different is that he's a pretty much polished outfielder. He takes good routes in the outfield. He's got great speed and range, and he also has got a very powerful throwing arm.
Tom, finally, an outfield prospect who has not reached full season baseball yet that you have your eye on.
All right, I'm going to give you two real quickly. Split this up here. Nelson Velasquez, who was chosen by the Cubs in the fifth round last year, scouts already feel that he is the best power prospect in the entire Cubs system. Last year, in only 32 games, he hit eight home runs in the rookie league. He's very raw as far as his baseball skills go, both in the field and at the plate. But there's somebody to look forward to. The other prospect I want to give guys for the future is his name is Fernando Kelly, a switch hitting outfielder that played in the Dominican League last year. Kelly has only been around for 2 years, 19 years old, has already got 81 stolen bases in 111 games, swiped 58 bases last year, along with hitting .320. Of course, as a young player, he's going to have to develop a little bit more. He's going to need to fill out a little bit more, but he has got a lot of potential.
Tom, you write for the Cubs Den. Tell our listeners how they can read more about what's going on in the Cubs system at the Cubs Den.
You can reach us at Chicago Now/Cubs Den. We have a three-member minor league coverage with myself. Michael Ernst, who does mainly our scouting and writes our scouting reports, and Stephanie Lynn, who also, like me, does the feature profiles of the players out there in the minor leagues.
ChicagoNow.com/Cubsden. That's where you'll find a lot of Chicago Cubs coverage, including those from Tom Uziak, minor league correspondent. He'll be back next Wednesday as we talk about another position in the Chicago Cubs system. Tom, thank you for the time, and we look forward to next Wednesday.
Look forward to being with you also on Locked On Cubs, too.
Okay, very good. Tom, thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, Tom Uziak from the Cubs Den, the latest on prospects in the Chicago Cubs system. Boy, a couple of years ago, we had Martinez, DeWeese, and Jimenez, and that was a lot of fun. Three high-level guys. And now DeWeese was traded to Kansas City. Eloy was traded to the White Sox, and Martinez is the guy that Tom talked about who's still trying to find himself after coming from Cuba. But he's got a lot of pop in the bat. It's just making a little more contact and has a cannon for an arm. It is now 11 minutes in front of the top of the hour. Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat brought to you by Budweiser on Michiana Sports Leader, 96.1 FM, WSBT. Abby, thank you. The forecast brought to you by EatDrinkDTSB.com. At Fiddler's Hearth, you could enjoy lamb epigrum, roasted chicken breast, pan-seared trout and coffee, and juniper-crusted pork tenderloin. Once again, at Fiddler's Hearth.
The Leprechaun Lunch with former Irish quarterback Evan Sharpley and WSBT Radio's Sean Stiers. Friday at noon on 96.1 FM, WSBT.
And the guy co-hosting that program is here, Sean Stiers.
Is he? What?
Any idea what's on the to-do list this Friday?
That's a good question.
Okay.
It's been from our standpoint, it's been a slower Notre Dame week. I'm sure we'll talk some Notre Dame basketball because we have the Fighting Irish heading to NC State on Saturday. We'll probably work a little Super Bowl in there with the Super Bowl coming up this weekend. Other than that, it's just wide open right now.
It's a free-for-all.
That's right.
All right, Leprechaun Lunch coming up Friday from noon to 1 here on 96.1 FM, WSBT. A couple of college basketball notes. As Sean mentioned, the Irish off until Saturday when they play at North Carolina State. Noon tip on 96.1 FM, WSBT. Mike Bray will meet the media tomorrow, so we will get an update on whether injured players Matt Farrell and DJ Harvey are possibilities to take the floor on the home of the Carolina Hurricanes in Raleigh. So maybe some help on the way for the Fighting Irish. How about the ACC last night? Clemson cannot beat North Carolina in Chapel Hill, but they got the Tar Heels last night at home, 82-78. And now, you look at the ACC standings, Virginia 9-0, Louisville 6-2. Duke is tied with Clemson for third at 7-3. Then you got Florida State and NC State at 5-4, and Carolina in seventh place with a record of 5-5. They're gettable, as we saw here in South Bend.
Yeah, after back-to-back seasons where they finished national runner-up and then national champion, they've come back to the pack a little bit, but I think you'll probably take that trade-off after the couple years that they had with that crew.
No doubt.
And the question is, can you keep winning? I don't know.
I don't think so. They're not going to make that run this year. Yeah. Notre Dame in 13th place right now in the ACC. Hard to imagine with that 3-6 record as they deal with all the injuries that have really held them back during the ACC season. Last night in the Big Ten Conference, Ohio State over Indiana, 71-56. The Buckeyes are 10-1, a half a game behind the 10-0 Boilermakers, who host Maryland at 8:30 tonight. Hoosiers 5-6 in the Big Ten. You know, this Big Ten tournament in New York City stinks for so many reasons, including having to play a bunch of conference games in a row. Indiana playing 7 games in 17 days. That's ridiculous. Give me a break.
Come on. Agree with that.
Come on.
I wasn't ready for that.
I love Big Ten hockey, but Big Ten basketball, come on, Delaney.
Come on.
That's just too much.
Kidding me.
And IU is 1-4 during this stretch, and they still have to play at Rutgers.
Oof.
And home against Minnesota. So those two are very winnable. Then they get 5 days off before hosting Chief Illini Wick. So Indiana going through a tough stretch, and no team should have to play that many games in those many days. Not in favor of that. Quick timeout. SportsBeat continues next on WSBT. Brought to you by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some buds. Eric, Sean, and Tom Noy hosting the program tomorrow. It is the top of the hour at WSBT South Bend.